the road to serfdom, I'd start by talking about chapter 15, something that Hayek says in chapter 15, and it's Lord Acton, the famous Lord Acton. Everyone has probably heard the famous quote from Lord Acton, "Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely." And Lord Acton was a British intellectual. He was an advisor to the Prime Minister Gladstone. He was actively writing around the time of the American Civil War and for the next several decades. He's known as a historian of liberty and a libertarian. He was a prominent Catholic in Victorian England. And if you, like I said, you've all heard his famous quote. But the quote that Hayek chose to put on the top of chapter 15 summarizes the topic of chapter 15. And it's worth my repeating it. Acton said, "Of all the checks on democracy, federation," by which he means federalism, by the way, in the American sense, "has been the most efficacious and the most congenial. The federal system limits and restrains the sovereign power by dividing it and by assigning to government only certain defined rights. It is the only method of curbing not only the majority, but the power of the whole people." And so what he's talking about here is what James Madison, the American founding father James Madison, called divided sovereignty. The American system of constitutional government had two different theories regarding how this constitution in theory was to constrain government. One was checks and balances. It's sort of a horizontal constraint where the power would be divided between the executive, congressional, and judicial branches. And supposedly the three branches would check each other if one got out of control and started doing things that were unconstitutional. That hasn't worked out too well. The other type of check that Madison championed was a vertical check, and that he called it divided sovereignty, and it really was embodied in the 10th Amendment. Okay, and the 10th Amendment basically says that certain powers are delegated to the central government. Okay, and it's Article 1, Section 8 lists the constitutional functions of the central government. And then the 10th Amendment of the Constitution says that all other things are the prerogative of the states and the people, respectively. And so, in theory, if this Constitution was ever to be enforced as a limit on government, the only way it would work, especially according to the Jeffersonians, was that if the people themselves, organized in political communities at the state and local levels, would enforce it by themselves. You could not rely on the central government to enforce limits on its own powers, was the thinking. And this is what Lord Acton is talking about here when he's talking about federation. He's talking about divided sovereignty in the sense of James Madison. Okay. And so I thought I'd explain this in a little more detail from one of my books. And I'll refer you to another book. If you want a good book on the Jeffersonian view of the Constitution, and this is a view that has largely been whitewashed from American history. It's almost a big secret. The book would be by St. George Tucker. The man's name was St. George Tucker, and it's a view of the Constitution of the United States. St. George Tucker was a law professor at William & Mary. He took over the teaching post that Thomas Jefferson's teacher of the law, George Wythe, once held, and he was the adoptive father of John Randolph of Roanoke, and he was quite a prominent Virginian in his time. And here's one of the things he said in view of the Constitution of the United States: "The union of the sovereignty of a state with the central government constitutes a state of usurpation and absolute tyranny over the people. Moreover, if the unlimited authority of the central state were to extend so far as to change the Constitution itself, The government, whatever be its form, is absolute and despotic, end quote. So St. George Tucker, in his exposition of the Jeffersonian view of the Constitution, is saying here that if the central government ever has the ability to monopolize the interpretation of the Constitution, then we will live under tyranny and usurpation, as he said. And this has been true essentially since the Civil War. The end of the Civil War is sort of the breaking point when the Supreme Court became essentially the sole arbiter of constitutionality. There was no longer states' rights, nullification, secession. That was all swept aside. Okay. He went on to say, this is St. George Tucker, said, the doctrine of non-resistance against arbitrary power and oppression as exercised by a central government is absurd, slavish, and destructive to the good and happiness of mankind. This is sort of similar to Jefferson's statement that on the tree of liberty must spill the blood of patriots and tyrants. These men were quite radical. Tucker goes on to say that a free government must be bound to the Constitution by its creators, namely the several states in the Union and the citizens thereof. And that was a direct quote. So that's what Madison was talking about when I referred to Madison earlier about divided sovereignty. And that's what Lord Acton is talking about in the quote at the top of chapter 15 of The Road to Serfdom. Tucker had a contemporary, John Taylor, who was a senator from the state of Virginia. And he wrote a book called Tyranny Unmasked, which is I highly recommend. It's a great critique of mercantilism and protectionism in the early 1800s. And he said this, being an essential principle for preserving liberty, the Constitution never could have designed to destroy it, that is, destroy liberty, by investing five or six men installed for life with a power of regulating the constitutional rights of all political departments. So these men thought it was outrageous to think that the Constitution could limit government if it was interpreted only by the central state. And since we're mentioning Lord Acton here, Lord Acton, in one of my publications, Lord Acton communicated with Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, after the end of the Civil War, 1866. And it's very interesting correspondence that Lee and Acton had. Lord Acton, the great historian of liberty. And let me read to you what Lord Acton said. This was a letter he wrote to Robert E. Lee on November 4th, 1866. And of course, the war was over. And this is Lord Acton's take on the meaning of the ending of the war. And by the way, Acton was one of many British intellectuals, European intellectuals, who did not believe the war was fought over to end slavery. He thought the principal battle that was going on was the battle of whether America would have a centralized government or it would maintain its system of federalism that was created by the Founding Fathers. And here's what Lord Acton said in his letter to Robert E. Lee on November 4th, 1866. He said, I saw in states' rights the only availing check upon the absolutism of the sovereign will, and secession filled me with hope not as the destruction but as the redemption of democracy. The institutions of your republic have not exercised on the old world the salutary and liberating influence which ought to have belonged to them by reason of those defects and abuses of principle which the Confederate Constitution was expressly and wisely calculated to remedy. I believe that the example of that great reform would have blessed all the races of mankind by establishing true freedom purged of the native dangers and disorders of republics. Therefore, I deem that you were fighting the battles of our liberty, our progress, and our civilization. And I mourn for the stake which was lost at Richmond more deeply than I rejoice over that which was saved at Waterloo. End quote. That was the Lord Acton. And he's referring to the Confederate Constitution, which was essentially identical to the U.S. Constitution with a few exceptions. The president had one 6-year term. There were term limits on members of Congress. The general welfare clause was eliminated. It did not exist. Protectionist tariffs were outlawed in the Confederate Constitution. U.S. Constitution, both of them legalized slavery. It was legal under the U.S. Constitution, and it was legal in the Confederate Constitution. But the Confederate Constitution did more to limit government, and that's what Lord Acton is talking about. Okay, and so Robert E. Lee responded. And here's what Robert E. Lee said in his response. Lee said, "While I have considered the preservation of the constitutional power of the general government to be the foundation of our peace and safety at home and abroad, I yet believe that the maintenance of the rights and authority reserved to the states and to the people not only are essential to the adjustment and balance of the general system, but the safeguard to the continuance of a free government. I consider it as the chief source of stability to our political system, whereas," and here's the important part, "whereas the consolidation of the states into one vast republic is sure to be aggressive abroad and despotic at home, and will be the certain precursor of that ruin which has overwhelmed all those that have preceded it." And so, you know, was there ever a truer prediction that the government would become aggressive abroad and despotic at home once it was centralized and there was no longer any such thing, really, as federalism or states' rights? And so that's what Lee was saying to him. And so, and as I said, this is the theme of this chapter 15, you know, one, the concluding chapter of The Road to Serfdom, because Hayek was fearful that after the war, after World War II, the movement to create some sort of one-world government or some sort of international government, sort of a super United Nations, would take place. And he was warning against the absurdity of thinking that. The centralization, the whole theme of The Road of Serfdom is the evils of the centralization of power and the imposition of one plan on a whole society. And to think that that thinking would be applied internationally, it's bad enough when you talk about this in terms of one country, but internationally would be horrible. And so, and to give you an idea, these men are not inventing these ideas. This the decentralization of governmental power goes back thousands of years. People have always known that this was an important way of protecting liberty, not making the world perfect, but at least giving us a chance, an escape route from governmental tyranny anyway. And to give you a few more examples of some of the literature of the last generation, Frank Chodorov, last name is spelled Chodorov, and he wrote, he was an old right libertarian, and he wrote a great book called The Income Tax, Root of All Evil, which I highly recommend. And in it, he says this on this subject of federalism. He says, "The real obstacle to tyranny is the psychological resistance to centralization that the states' rights tradition fosters. The citizen of divided allegiance cannot be reduced to subservience. If he is in the habit of serving two political gods, small g, he cannot be dominated by either one. No political authority ever achieved absolutism until the people were deprived of a choice of loyalties." So that's Frank Chodorov recognizing the importance of states' rights, federalism, which are really synonyms. Here's what Ludwig von Mises wrote in his book Omnipotent Government, which I also highly recommend that everyone read. He's talking about the growth of government in the United States and in Switzerland at the time. Mises had fled to Geneva shortly before he eventually came to the United States at the outbreak of World War II. Mises had been a prominent critic of socialism and of fascism and the Nazi regime in particular, and he was Jewish, and so he had to get out of town. He left Vienna for Geneva, and then he made his way across Europe to America by some kind of miracle and ended up in New York City teaching at NYU. But here's what he said in Omnipotent Government: "New powers accrued not to the member states," that is, with the growth of government, "but to the federal government," meaning the central government. "Every step toward more government interference and more planning means at the same time an expansion of the jurisdiction of the central government. Washington and Bern once the seats of federal governments, that is, decentralized governments. Today, they are capitals in the true sense of the word, and the states and cantons are virtually reduced to the status of provinces. And here's an important passage. He says, "It is a very significant fact that the adversaries of the trend toward more government control describe their opposition as a fight against Washington and against Bern, the capital of Switzerland, i.e. against centralization. It is conceived as a contest of states' rights versus the central power." End quote. That's Ludwig von Mises, and Grayson has the book cover up there on the screen. One more example of an old classical liberal saying, commenting on this topic, is Felix Morley, M-O-R-L-E-Y, another great book that I recommend, Freedom and Federalism by Felix Morley. This really is a great book. I think you really enjoy this if you like The Road to Serfdom and you like this class. And here's what Morley said. "Socialism and federalism, that is, states' rights, are necessarily political opposites because the former demands that the centralized concentration of power, which the latter, by definition, denies." Okay, so the former defies the centralization, concentration of power, rather, which the latter denies. Okay, so that's just some 20th century writers who are expressing these views. And of course, this has nothing to do with slavery or racism or Jim Crow laws or anything like that. The enemies of decentralized power, the champions of big government and centralized power for generations, have used the red herring of associating federalism with slavery and racism as a way of censoring all discussion of it. But these men weren't making the case for slavery or racism or anything like that. They were making a case for liberty, and people had for hundreds of years before them, by appealing to decentralization. And so this is what Hayek is talking about here. He's making the case for federalism. Okay, a few more things on federalism. I don't want to beat this to death, but the whole idea of federalism really is a uniquely American idea, at least in the last couple hundred years. And there's a Forrest MacDonald is an American historian who's pretty well known. He's retired now. He taught at the University of Alabama for years, and he wrote a book called States' Rights. And here's what he says about states' rights or federalism in one passage near the conclusion. He says, "Political scientists and historians are in agreement that federalism is the greatest contribution of the founding fathers to the science of government. It is also the only feature of the Constitution that has been successfully exported that can be employed to protect liberty elsewhere in the world. Yet what we invented and others imitate no longer exists on its native shores." So this was Forrest MacDonald about 10 years ago, saying that we invented federalism really with the U.S. Constitution, but it no longer exists here. There are other countries that practice it, Switzerland being the most prominent, I would say, but no longer here. And what he meant is that we no longer have, at that time, rights of nullification or secession. That was ended by the Civil War, and that's what Forrest MacDonald is writing about. And to give you an idea, I mentioned earlier that this idea that Hayek is writing about is uniquely American, and it's associated with what I call the Jeffersonian tradition in constitutional interpretation. I want to read a few things by Jefferson on secession, on the citizens of a state leaving the Union if they think that the government has become tyrannical and is breaking the constitutional compact. And keep in mind that Jefferson, of course, was the author of the American Declaration of Independence, which was the declaration of secession or separation from the British Empire. And the final paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, which Americans rarely ever hear or see, and people who quote the Declaration are always quoting the "all men are created equal" part, but they never quote this part that says, and this is a declaration addressed to the King of Great Britain at the time, "that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other things which independent states may of right do." End quote. And independent states, they considered themselves to be independent countries. So New York considered itself to be an independent country, like France and Spain were independent countries. That's how the founders thought, and they were banding together to separate from the British Empire. That's what they were forming a union to do, a voluntary union. And Jefferson, and that was Jefferson, those were Jefferson's words, the author of the American Declaration of Secession, as I call it. Later on in his life, when Jefferson was elected President of the United States, and he gave his first inaugural address, which is one of the best speeches in his political speeches in American history, as far as I'm concerned, he said this: "If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this Union or to change its republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left to combat it," end quote. And so he was saying, if anybody wants to leave the Union, it is voluntary after all, good luck. Good luck. It'll be a monument to us in which we tolerate error of opinion. That is, he's saying he thinks it's a very bad idea to split up the Union, but we will do nothing to stop you. On January 29th, 1804, Jefferson wrote a letter to a Dr. Joseph Priestley on the issue of secession. He said this: "Whether we remain in one confederacy or form into Atlantic and Mississippi confederacies, I believe not very important to the happiness of either part. Those of the Western Confederacy will be as much of our children and descendants as those of the Eastern, and I feel myself as much identified with that country in future time as with this. And I now foresee a separation at some future date, yet I should feel the duty and desire to promote the Western interests as zealously as the Eastern, doing all the good for both portions of our future family which should fall within my power." And finally, another letter, Grayson beat me to it. I was going to mention, this is quoted in this article of mine called Happy Secession Day, which Lou Rockwell reprinted on the 4th of July. Another letter, August 12th, 1803, to John Breckinridge. If there were a separation, Jefferson wrote, he said, "God bless them both and keep them in the Union if it be for their good, but separate them if it be better." Very stark difference from Abraham Lincoln, who in his first inaugural address literally threatened an invasion, a military invasion of any state that failed to collect the newly doubled federal tariff tax after seceding from the Union. And so the purpose of all this discussion is to amplify the theme of Chapter 15, where Hayek is talking about federalism as a guarantor of liberty, and also warning against the idea of really of creating a European Union, is what he's sort of talking about. Okay, and so when Hayek does talk about what's going to happen after the war, he knows there was a movement to create some sort of international body. The League of Nations advocates never did go away. And he was worried that they would try to create a new form of League of Nations and give it some governmental powers and even an army to enforce its powers with. And he's warning that this is a horrible idea. You know, all of the bad things about a planned society that he talked about in the first 14 chapters, he says, would be orders of magnitude worse if we have international planning. And of course, they did adopt something like that immediately after World War II. It was called communism in Central and Eastern Europe. So keep in mind, this was 1944. This was before FDR gave Europe away to Stalin, and so they did adopt the worst of all worlds immediately after the war that Hayek was warning about. And the discussion in this chapter, the warnings about an international governmental body and the praise of federalism, I think is colored by Hayek's understanding of economics, the economics of monopoly in particular. And so what he's talking about is competition between governments. One one way in which political scientists have looked at federalism is that they've called it a laboratory of experimentation, where state governments, or whatever you want to call them, local governments, would experiment with different policies, and the better ones, the ones that worked better, would succeed because people would move there, businesses would move there, they would thrive economically. The ones that had bad experiments, that didn't do so good, would suffer, sort of like industrial competition. On the other hand, there are writers who don't like to think of citizens as rats in an experimental cage, and have always looked at federalism more as an escape route from tyranny, not as a laboratory of experimentation where the citizens can be experimented on like rats, like I said. And what Hayek is referring to in his discussion of federalism here is the idea that you might have some governments in, say, a big European, look at the continent of Europe. What would an international governmental body do? Well, it'll try to homogenize taxes and regulations and just governmental policies in general. Why would it do that? Well, it doesn't want one country to have a competitive edge over other countries, or it doesn't want one group of countries to have a competitive edge economically over other countries. You might note in this chapter he talks about the futility of trying to equalize incomes. And so you'll have sort of a combination, a coalition of Baptists and bootleggers. Economists used to talk about the political coalition for prohibition, alcohol prohibition in the 1920s, as Baptists and bootleggers. The Baptists wanted a prohibition for religious reasons. The bootleggers wanted prohibition for economic reasons. They sold illegal booze, and if it became legal, they'd be out of business. Well, Hayek is referring to something like that here. He's talking about the ideologues who want to try to, who socialists, who want to equalize income, but there are also businesses who want to use this, who would want to use this international body to impose onerous regulations and taxes on smaller countries so that they could not compete as successfully with them in the bigger countries. And that is exactly what the European Union has done. The European Union has homogenized, or it's doing its best to homogenize taxes and regulations. For example, if Ireland, let's say, decides it wants to cut taxes and regulations and have free trade and be a libertarian republic that'll prosper, capital and people will flow to Ireland then from elsewhere in Europe. It'll be much more conducive to earning a living and thriving there. And so the purpose of an international governmental body, Hayek warned, would be to keep Ireland from doing that. And essentially, it's a cartel arrangement. He's warning against a cartel of governments. What do cartels do in the economic world? Well, they conspire to fix prices higher than the free market price. That's what they would do. That's what cartels do. This is what governments do when they get together and form unions of governments. That's the European Union. That's exactly the purpose of the European Union. This is also prevalent in the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was, when was it, 15 years ago? It's been quite some time that was passed. But a part of that agreement said that they would try to homogenize regulations. And why would they do that? Well, there were a lot of American companies that are very unhappy that they didn't have as environmental regulations that are quite as onerous as they are in the United States, in Mexico. And so a part of this agreement is that Mexico would be forced to increase the cost of doing business in Mexico by eventually adopting American-style environmental regulations and also American-style labor union rules and laws that are dictated by law. And so, and again, the American companies that were unionized were afraid that the less expensive labor in Mexico would cause companies to leave the United States and go to Mexico, and so they wanted to homogenize the cost of labor the best they could, increase the cost of labor. Hayek mentions the example of minimum wage laws in Chapter 15, and he's referring exactly to this of companies in bigger countries, he says, would push for minimum wage laws in smaller countries because they would want to price them out of the market. They would want to increase the cost of labor in those countries and make it harder for businesses in those countries to compete with them. That's what he's talking about. See, on the chat, someone mentions Bruce Yandel. Yeah, Bruce Yandel's an economist at Clemson University. who's known for inventing, I don't think he invented it, but he popularized the bootleggers and Baptist comments. Okay. There's one comment that Hayek makes here. Someone had a question about it a couple of weeks ago, a question about internationalism, when Hayek was referring in an earlier chapter to internationalism. He does it again here, where he distinguishes, he uses the phrase international relations, and he distinguishes between international relations between individuals and between states, between governments. And I think this is an important thing to understand in understanding what Hayek is saying here. He's, you know, when we hear this phrase international relations, we usually think of the Secretary of State negotiating with the Foreign Minister of England or someplace like that. Hayek is talking about two different kinds. International relations means if I buy a Japanese car, that's an international relation. I'm buying it from somebody in Tokyo. There's no negotiation between Hillary Clinton and the Japanese Foreign Minister involved in this. It's just a commercial action. And so he's saying, yes, we want international relations between individuals, but international relations between states inevitably leads to conflict and war in many cases because of nationalism. Once we get on the road of thinking of international relations as primarily or only between governments, then it turns into nationalism, and each government will want to enact policies that, like protectionism and subsidies for its own businesses that impair trade between the countries and would actually harm individual relations between the two countries by cutting off or reducing the amount of commercial trade. And that, he's distinguishing between that. Okay. One of the disappointing things about Hayek in this chapter, this final chapter, is disappointing to me anyway, is that he makes the case for some kind of international authority if the international authority can be constrained to enforcing the rule of law. And so he harshly condemns the idea of any kind of international authority engaging in any kind of social planning or central planning, economic planning, but he says if they enforce the rule of law, which presumably would mean using an army to eliminate wars, to police warmongering. And it's disappointing because he seems, Hayek was always a little too Pollyannish about minimal government, about the ability to keep government at a minimum that would only do these things. And of course, this was the whole project of the American Founding Fathers. They wanted to have a government to conduct certain functions, primarily for a central government, primarily for war, national defense, and foreign policy reasons. If you look at Article 1, Section 8, it's primarily those. But the great project, James Madison said, was to try to keep the government minimized to those things so that it wouldn't expand and turn America into a democracy where everything was determined by politics. Well, it didn't really work out that way. And one of the reasons I'm disappointed of what Hayek says here is that he makes no mention of secession. What if there was such an international authority comprised of, say, a dozen countries, and it did turn into something that did not just enforce the rule of law, as Hayek would approve of, but became sort of a European Union that was trying to tinker with central planning. It becomes captured by the three or four largest countries, and ends up working for their benefit at the expense of the benefit of other people. If you have the ability to just leave, it could conceivably work the way Hayek thinks it could work. But I would note that the European Union's constitution does not permit secession. I don't know what they would do if a country would secede. That's hard to imagine. They would gang up and invade. But in today's crazy world, who knows? Anyway, I think Hayek was unduly naive about this when he talked about favorably about some sort of international organization that could conceivably enforce the rule of law and avoid war in the future. And I'm trying to read some of the chats here. Maybe I won't. Okay. The chapter on totalitarians in our midst, I thought I'd make 2 points about that and give you some information about it. One piece of information I'll give you about the totalitarians in our midst is I wrote about this in my book, How Capitalism Saves America, Saved America. There's a chapter entitled Anti-Capitalism in it. And I'd recommend a book entitled Political Pilgrims. I put a short article with the title Political Pilgrims on the syllabus, on the reading list. But there's a whole book by a sociologist named Paul Hollander, H-O-L-L-A-N-D-E-R, called Political Pilgrims. And the whole book, it was published, I think, in the early 80s. And it's about trips that American and other Western intellectuals made to totalitarian societies, beginning with the Soviet Union in the early 20th century. And then they would come back and write books and articles about how wonderful life was under communism. And talking about totalitarians in our midst, I mean, that's it. And I'll mention just a few examples. Hollander quotes a minister named D.F. Buxton, who wrote this. He wrote how, quote, "The communist view of human nature seems to me far more inspired by faith, hope, and charity than our own. To them, the prime cause of evil is the poison of wealth." So this is one minister who went to the Soviet Union and came back and said that. The American intellectual Theodore Dreiser visited the Kremlin in the early days of the Soviet Union and said this: The rooms of Lenin in the Kremlin offer perhaps a classical example of the simplicity and frugality of the present-day rulers of Russia," end quote. And he went on to say that in Moscow there is poverty and there are beggars in the streets, but Lord, how picturesque the multicolored and voluminous rags of all of them. I'm not making this up. Theodore Dreiser, a very famous intellectual, said, "Yeah, they have bums in the Soviet Union, but they're very colorful bums, very colorful on the streets." Getting back to Buxton again, he's talking about Soviet communism. He praised it, quote, "for its sense of moral advance and the emphasis they place on the spirit of service, which has supposedly taken to heart some of the most important maxims of the New Testament. Their society is a more Christian one than ours." And then, of course, Christianity was outlawed in the Soviet Union. And when they did allow churches to exist eventually, the KGB essentially ran them and monitored them. And many of the priests were actually KGB agents, according to my old friend Yuri Maltsev, who grew up in the Soviet Union and eventually worked for Gorbachev. And he's a defector. He defected shortly before the Soviet Union collapsed, and he told me that's why he's no longer a Russian Orthodox, but an Episcopalian, because of the bad experiences he had in his old Russian Orthodox church, where the ministers, the priests, were all KGB agents, spies for the government. John Dewey, one of the founders of American public education, said this. He said, "Communism was, quote, intrinsically religious and had the moving spirit and force of primitive Christianity." He just loved it. The most famous person was Walter Duranty, which is in the article, Political Pilgrims, that I put on the reading list. And Walter Duranty said this, one of the things he said, now this is a time when millions of Ukrainians were starving to death. 6 million Ukrainians were killed by forced starvation. The government of the Soviet Union purposely starved out the breadbasket of Europe, the Ukraine. And Walter Duranty says this. He said, "The Russian granaries were overflowing with grain. The cows are plump and contented." Yeah, that's a quote. George Bernard Shaw said that, quote, "there was not and could not be a food shortage in the USSR. Of course, Stalin's forced collectivization caused the death of 6 million people in less than 1 year. And One final quote. W.E.B. Du Bois thought Stalin was, quote, a perfect gentleman who asked for neither adulation nor vengeance. He was reasonable and conciliatory. And so those are some of our American political pilgrims in the 20th century. And this book goes on to talk about people who did the same thing in Vietnam and Cuba and you know, anywhere where there's totalitarianism, you can count on these people to go there and come back to this country and praise it. In the same book, for one example, is there's a more contemporary writer named Jonathan Kozol, K-O-Z-O-L, who has made several trips to Cuba, and he even lectured at my university a few years ago, and said made the case for why Americans should adopt the Cuban-style education system. And people like him are always advocating Cuban-style medicine. But my friend Yuri Maltsev, who I just mentioned, has been in Cuba on several occasions, and he tells me the only medicine in Cuba is to swim to Miami as soon as possible. He said you could not even find aspirin anywhere in Cuba, let alone decent health care if you were an average citizen. Okay, so that's my one example. Another example of this idea of totalitarians in our midst is several years ago, I wrote an article on lewrockwell.com that was entitled Godfather Crystal's Statist Imperialist Manifesto about Irving Kristol. And I was motivated to write this article because Irving Kristol, the late Irving Kristol, had written an article in the Weekly Standard magazine August 25th of, I think it was 08, I'm not exactly sure what year it was, calling him, saying that, well, people have been calling me the godfather of neoconservatism, and so, well, yeah, I am, and here's what I believe. And here it is up on the screen. And I quote him as saying that the historical task and political purpose of neoconservatism would seem to be this: to convert the Republican Party and the American conservatives in general, against their respective wills, into a new kind of conservative politics suitable to governing a modern democracy. And he directly criticizes Hayek in this article of his from the Weekly Standard, and where he mocks the idea of limited government by calling it, quote, the Hayekian notion that we are on the road to serfdom, end quote. And he is not just criticizing Hayek, he's criticizing the whole classical liberal tradition here. And he uses just Hayek and the road to serfdom as a hook to discuss his criticism of the whole idea that government should be limited. And so, of course, that's what neoconservatives are all about, is they're not against big government at all, as long as it can be used for their purposes. You know, they're right-wing statists, after all. And it was interesting to me that he picked on Hayek in particular. And he says this, for example, he says, quote, for a great power, there are no boundaries to its pursuit of national interest. And so he makes the case for imperialism, basically, for an imperialistic foreign policy. And he directly attacks Hayek in particular. And so if you want to know about the totalitarians in our midst, I think a lot of the so-called neoconservatives would fit in there. And there's one passage in this chapter 15 where Hayek refers to certain people that seem to have some sort of love for war. If I can find it. Well, anyway, no, it's not chapter 15. It's probably in the totalitarian chapter. Here it is. It's on page 200. He talks about people who rejoice in the sense of meaning and purpose which war, the most powerful instrument of social solidarity, creates. And when I read this, it reminded me of Victor Davis Hanson, who's sort of a celebrated neoconservative writer, who has written a book on war, and he taught for a while at Hillsdale College as a guest lecturer, and I had several students email me and tell me this guy loves war. He just loves war. That's what they got out of his semester-long course on war at Hillsdale College, that this guy loves war. And so when I read that statement by Hayek, warning of these sort of crazies, that he's warning us about in his time, in 1944, who seem to love the idea of war. They think it gives us a moral purpose as human beings. That's the neoconservatives. It's one of the neoconservative mantras. Okay. One final thing that Hayek talks about here is that's dubious, I think, is he makes the case, as does Ludwig von Mises, by the way, that it's legitimate under a liberal policy, under classical liberalism, to sacrifice some freedom in the present in order to guarantee more freedom in the future. And they're talking about war. And of course, they just say war. I have to assume they mean defensive wars with sacrificed freedom. But even that, just making a general statement like that is problematic. Because they don't say how are we supposed to sacrifice freedom specifically, military conscription, just even from a utilitarian perspective, that's a very bad idea. The volunteer armies are always more efficient than conscripts, just as free labor is more efficient than slave labor, for example. During the American Civil War, when the writ of habeas corpus was suspended by Abraham Lincoln, that was not done during the War of 1812 by James Madison, the father of the Constitution, as he is called, even though the British had invaded America and burned down the White House. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, did not think it was necessary to shut down the opposition newspapers and suspend habeas corpus like Lincoln did, and the nation survived. And so if you look at, what kind of freedoms should we sacrifice? Hayek doesn't really specify here, and Mises doesn't either, really, in his Human Action, his great book Human Action. But they both say this, that it might be necessary to sacrifice freedom now in waging a defensive war to have more freedom in the future, that is, not to be conquered by a tyrant. So they make a good point, but they're very vague on that. And that's, I guess I have 7:47, and that's what I want to say about these three chapters, the three ending chapters, and I have a bunch of questions for you. Let me look at the chat here. Oh no, Lisa has a cousin who's a big time neocon. That's too bad about that. But I'll move into some of the questions here that I got as of about an hour ago. I printed them out. And let's see, the first question written down here is from James Collins, who's busy on Sunday writing the question. Hayek and the Austrian economists rightly elevate the individual above the state, champion limited government, and condemn what we today call crony capitalism. The distributists also share these ideals and place emphasis on the widespread ownership of private property. The two schools disagree on the methods to achieve these ends, most notably the distributists' rejection of the price system, which by default requires a heavy-handed government authority to set prices and wages. Could I comment on the flaws of this? Well, we already have commented on the flaws of that. It's you can't have a rational economy without private property in a free market pricing system. What free market pricing system does is it gives us as consumers and as business people the proper signals. When something becomes more scarce, it drives up the price. It tells us as consumers it's time to conserve, time to cut back. It tells producers what? It tells them it's time to produce more. There's a need for more because it's scarce. It's time to search for substitutes for this good because it is now becoming scarce. Either way, it helps human civilization to thrive that way. And so operating an economy without free market prices is like trying to navigate your way around a foreign city without street signs. It's impossible for us to make rational economic calculations as business people or as consumers without the price system. And so to claim that you're in favor of freedom and liberty but against the price system is an absurdity. It's a complete absurdity We've had thousands of years of history, and not just economic theory, but thousands of years of history. I would recommend, I wrote a little essay for Mises.org. It was a bit of a book review on a book called 40 Centuries of Price Controls by Eamon Butler and a co-author, Bob Schudinger. Eamon Butler and Bob Schudinger, 40 Centuries of Price Controls. And they do talk about 40 centuries of price controls, of how government-controlled prices have created calamities, shortages, mass starvation for thousands and thousands of years. And so it's an impossibility to call yourself a champion of limited government and also government control of prices. You cannot have a rational economy, and it'll lead to catastrophe. And what governments inevitably do when you have catastrophes such as starvation and poverty is to gain more and more and more power, because they never ever want to admit that they failed, that they're failing to plan. That's Hayek has said this over and over again in The Road to Serfdom. Okay, let's see. I think that's it for that question. The next question by Joseph Green. Did, quote, propaganda have a different meaning in the 1940s? It would be hard for me to believe that totalitarian governments could get away with calling their own message propaganda and have the people accept it as true. Well, you know, the Catholic Church had a college of propaganda. Propaganda means to propagate. And so the Catholic Church was propagating the faith in its college of propaganda. And so the word back then, when they had this, it did not have the negative connotation that it does now. You know, now we assume it just simply means, you know, lies, myths, and so forth. But right, it did not always have that negative connotation. It just meant to propagate an idea. Okay, and so the next question by Lisa Pate. Several of the events of the past 2 years are so similar to the early years of the Great Depression, specifically that FDR just continued Hoover's policies, and now Obama is continuing many of the Bush's bad economic and foreign policies. I was wondering if you could share with us your thoughts on which of these policies will be most detrimental to the economy and or unemployment over the next few years. Well, it just so happens that I've written an article on this on lewrockwell.com entitled A Recipe for the Next Great Depression, and it's basically a short review of a great book on the New Deal called FDR's Folly by Jim Powell. And Jim Powell he gathered up all the academic research that he could find on the actual effects of FDR's New Deal and summarized it in plain English, chapter after chapter, in this book, FDR's Folly. And so, and then in the last chapter, he gives a number of lessons that we should have learned from the Great Depression. And lesson number one is, and I'm quoting Jim Powell, the basic problem with central banks is that, like socialist economic planners, they can never have more than a fraction of the vast knowledge needed to make a society work. He's talking about the knowledge problem, the use of knowledge in society that we've talked about in the class. And so what's the lesson? It's a lesson that central banks can't centrally plan any better than anybody else can. Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan are no better at central planning than the Soviets were at central planning. And so, but what are we doing? We're expanding the powers of the central bank. And so not only have we not learned lesson number one about the failure of the Great Depression, we're going full bore ahead in repeating that mistake. Lesson number two is, according to Jim Powell, deposit insurance on banks must be priced to reflect the risks of the banks that buy it. Well, that would be private insurance. Private insurance, like private car insurance, reflects the risks. That's why 25-year-olds pay higher rates than 50-year-olds with same driving records. 25-year-olds simply pay more because of the probability of being in an accident, or under 25-year-olds pay more. But with federal deposit insurance, it socializes the risk so that banks all pay the same rate into the government for this insurance. It's taxpayers' funds go into it, and so it creates a moral hazard problem. If a bank is excessively risky, it's bailed out. It's bailed out by the taxpayers, and that's what deposit insurance is all about. That's what it does. And so, if you tell banks we will bail you out if you make bad business decisions, they're bound to make more bad business decisions than if they had private insurance, which they knew their rates would go up after they made for making bad business decisions. And that's what Jim Powell is talking about. We created this during the Great Depression, and it was a bad idea. Lesson number three, especially because taxes are the biggest burden on millions of people face today, it's crucial to cut taxes. Well, of course, we're not cutting taxes. The Obama administration has been raising taxes like crazy. And of course, one economic point here is that when you use the word tax, it's not just explicit taxes like the income tax. Government spending is a better measure of taxation than simply taxes, because the government will take the money from us one way or the other when it votes to spend it. So the amount the government spends is really the a better measuring rod of the burden of taxation. And so if the government will finance part of that by explicit taxes like the income tax, it'll finance some of it with borrowing, and we as the taxpayers are on the hook to pay off the principal and interest. It also crowds out private borrowing for home building, for business development, and so forth, or by printing money. And printing money creates price inflation eventually. It creates boom and bust cycles in the economy. And so we all pay a price for that too. And so government spending has certainly not been restrained by either Bush or Obama as far as that goes. And we haven't learned that lesson, that's for sure. No, we have, but the politicians never do. Lesson number four, efforts to soak the rich will backfire because the investments of the rich, quote, are needed to create jobs. Well, that's the whole ideology of the Obama administration, soak the rich. He's a socialist through and through, and so is everyone else in his administration. We're doing just the opposite. That's the whole purpose of his election, is to soak the rich some more. Lesson number five, public works and other jobs programs must be avoided because they increase cost and burden of government, making it more difficult for the private sector to function. Well, that's what the so-called trillions of stimulus is all about, isn't it? It's public works. I think I mentioned last class that the law, the so-called stimulus bill that was passed, makes sure that most of the money is scheduled to be spent this year, the election year, rather than last year, even though we were supposedly in an emergency economic situation. And so, we're doing just the opposite in spades compared to what FDR did. Lesson number six, according to Jim Powell, especially during a recession or depression, the government must not enact laws preventing prices from adjusting to circumstances. Well, that's the whole purpose of the Bernanke inflationary policy, to try to prop up housing and the stock market and other prices. And it's not as ridiculous or zany as Roosevelt was with price code police roaming the country, forcing businesses to raise their prices. But the Fed is handling most of this. That's the whole Fed's policy, is to prop up real estate prices and avoid the necessary adjustment that has to take place. Lesson number seven, according to Jim Powell and FDR's policy, FDR's folly, is that government must not enact laws preventing wages from adjusting to circumstances. Labor union monopolies have been major obstacles to adjusting wages, end quote. Well, of course, the current administration is empowering labor unions. They're getting a law passed to allow secret elections to take place for labor unions. And so they'll be strengthening labor unions. And in those industries that are unionized, they'll be doing their best to prop up wages during a recession, which will cause more unemployment. The final lesson I list here is lesson number eight. It's, quote, only if investors feel that private property is secure will they be willing to make long-term financial commitments needed to spur recovery and boost employment. Well, there's been a lot of complaining in the New York Times and elsewhere recently that businesses are sitting on hoards of cash. They're not investing. Of course, the reason they're not investing is the tremendous uncertainty that's being created by government. The Fed has $1 trillion in excess reserves sitting in the banks. No one knows when these banks are going to start lending this money, and when they do, it'll create price inflation. And with price inflation, there'll be even greater uncertainty, because we don't know what the rate of inflation will eventually be and settle in at. And also, there's the threat of nobody knows exactly what this socialized health care bill is going to cost until the bureaucrats start issuing regulations telling us how the thing will be enforced. And then the Obama administration wants a new energy series of energy taxes, and that'll affect every single business in America. The Bush tax cuts, as they're called, are scheduled to become defunct, and so the income tax rates and other tax rates are scheduled to go up. But then again, they might not. It's a political year. There's a political battle over that brewing right now, and all of this creates tremendous uncertainty in the eyes of business people. And that's why they're sitting on the sidelines and not investing. And so lesson number 8 is not being learned either, for sure. In other words, we're repeating all the bad mistakes that FDR did in spades, many times worse than he did right now. Which is why, by the way, the official government unemployment rate is just under 10%. I think I mentioned earlier in the class that the government doesn't count what it calls discouraged workers, people who have just given up looking for a job. If you count those, it's more like 17%. And that's depression era level of unemployment, 17%. So it's FDR's Folly is the name of the book, F-O-L-L-Y. This is, Grayson put this, this article on regime uncertainty. Our friend Robert Higgs wrote this article several years ago, I guess 13 years ago now, spring 1997, about all the uncertainty created by FDR's policies and how it negatively affected business investment during the Great Depression, and that once that uncertainty was diminished greatly after the war, after World War II, that's what caused business investment to really take off again. And contribute to the end of the Great Depression and the great boom that existed in the, right after World War II. And that's Robert Higgs's argument there. Okay, let's see. Another question by Mary Sodergren. In Chapter 15, Hayek talks about the dangers of international economic planning. He says on page 227 this: "Those who at least partly realize these dangers usually draw the conclusion that economic planning must be done internationally, i.e. by some supranational authority. But though this would avert some of the obvious dangers raised by planning on a national scale, it seems that those who advocate such ambitious schemes have little conception of the even greater difficulties and dangers which their proposals create. The problems raised by a conscious direction of economic affairs on a national scale inevitably assume even greater dimensions when the same is attempted internationally." I discussed that earlier. He then goes on to say, "To imagine that the economic life of a vast area comprising of many different people can be directed or planned by democratic procedure betrays a lack of awareness of the problems that could arise." I'll skip over the last sentence here. Question: wouldn't Hayek then disapprove of the World Bank and IMF and the significant role they play in the regulation of our global economy and consequently of our lives? Are we not treading on thin ice here with the power they wield? Won't this control of the global economy result in less and less freedom? Or am I so undereducated about the workings that I just don't get it? No, you're not uneducated about that. Hayek would not have approved of the World Bank and the IMF. The case he makes for any kind of international organization would be one that would enforce some kind of rule of law, general rules only, is what he says. But he doesn't specify, but he's very, very specific about planning. And the World Bank and the IMF have been all about central planning, very socialistic central planning, with foreign aid especially. And foreign aid has been largely a disaster. The one big name in the field of economics on foreign aid is Peter Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, who's written many, many great books. I think I mentioned him earlier in the course. There's another excellent book called Prosperity Versus Planning by David Osterfeld that has a great summary chapter on foreign aid. And I also believe there's a book published by the Cato Institute some years ago on sort of the history of foreign aid up until about 15 years ago, and I believe Doug Bando, B-A-N-D-O-W, is the editor, and it's a book of essays on different countries that have experienced the effects of the IMF and the World Bank in terms of foreign aid. And in each case, what generally happens, the aid is always government to government. So it creates bigger governments in foreign countries, and the bigger governments never create more prosperity. A lot of the money is stolen. It enriches the dictators in the third world, and it generally has a very bad effect. And even worse than that, it makes enemies in a lot of these countries, because there's an article by Peter Bauer, by James Dorn on the screen there. What often happens is the U.S. government will say, okay, to a third world country, we'll give you $10 billion, but you must use the $10 billion to buy international harvester tractors or some other combination of American goods. So it's really aid to American corporations. It's really corporate welfare, veiled corporate welfare. It's not really foreign aid. And then what the corporations do is say they've manufactured 1 million tractors, and 100,000 of them are defective. Guess which ones will be shipped to the third world country that is paying them with tax dollars? It'll be the defective ones, and this is what will happen. And so, and that again, we spend all this money, it goes abroad, and people resent it. And one of the things Peter Bauer was known for demonstrating is that our foreign food aid has been mostly corporate welfare for American farmers, because the same thing will happen. We will say, some of the programs will be, we will give you X dollars, but you have to use the money to buy food from American farmers. And sometimes we just ship the food there. Sometimes the government will just pay the American farmers directly to ship food to some country for foreign aid. And so they'll dump all this wheat or soybeans or whatever on the foreign country and drive the price of that product down to close to zero, making it impossible for farmers in those countries to earn a living. So we destroy their own agriculture industries with our foreign aid, and the farmers then move into the cities to look for work, and it makes the unemployment problem in the cities even worse than it already was. And so foreign aid has backfired, just like all schemes at central planning have backfired and been counterproductive, although somebody always makes a great deal of money out of it, many billions of dollars, as always. And so, yes, and Hayek would have been against all this. He knew Peter Bauer personally. They both lived in London at the same time for a while, and they were both members of the Mont Pelerin Society. Hayek was one of the founders of the Mont Pelerin Society, and so Hayek was well aware of all this research that I just mentioned, and he would have been dead against that. He was, when he mentions an international authority, he's only talking about theory, something that could enforce the rule of law. You know, keep in mind he's writing this when World War II is still going on, and the European countries are the people are slaughtering each other by the thousands day by day. I can understand why he would think, you know, something's got to be done to prevent this disaster in the future. And so he's a little more enthusiastic about an international authority than I would be. And of course, if he were alive today, he might not say the same thing. I really doubt that he would be so enthusiastic about some kind of international authority. Okay, let's see. One final question that I printed out anyway, by Roger Toutant. In Gordon's paper, he quotes Flynn, John T. Flynn, saying this, quote, "The New Deal has put itself into the position of needing a state of permanent crisis, or indeed permanent war, to justify its social interventions." Question: what are the permanent crises or wars that are used to justify today's social interventions? Well, you name it. In the 70s, it was the energy crisis, and when Ronald Reagan immediately deregulated the price of oil as the very first thing he did after being inaugurated president, that created a crisis for the interventionists. At the time, I was calling it a crisis, because the crisis was over. The free market worked, and it was a disaster. Today, right now, read the disappointing whining and crying in the news media over the fact that most of that oil that was spilled into the Gulf of Mexico is very difficult to find. They can't find it. It's been either evaporated, sunk back to the bottom, or bacteria have eaten it up, and so they thought it was the latest, a great example of a disaster, of a crisis. And of course, you might remember there's this statement that's been widely quoted by Obama's chief of staff, where he said, I could paraphrase him, let's never let a good crisis go to waste. He was talking about the economic depression that the Fed has created right now. There's a good example. And so the Obama administration, like FDR, is using the depression caused by the government to enact all these additional big government programs, of, you know, financial regulation, healthcare socialism, high taxes, so-called stimulus spending. That's all done in the name of this crisis. And so there you are, the war on poverty. You know, there's a crisis of poverty. There's a war on fat now. The government is telling us there are too many fat people. They're waging war on it, so they want to tax French fries and everything else. And of course, there's an endless search for new Hitlers in the world, whether it's Saddam Hussein or the nutcase who's the president of Iran, or the dictator of North Korea, whether they pose a threat to Americans or not. There's a constant search for a new bad guy, a new demon, a new Hitler, to justify more war. That's the neoconservative agenda, you know, to wage war in as many countries as possible. And so they're constantly ginning up scare stories in the media about these people, about the impending nuclear bomb that Iran is about to create, supposedly, for example. And of course, the war on drugs is another example of this. As the war on drugs has created a crisis, a crime crisis, among other things, in the cities. It's not just a theory. And so, that's what Flynn was talking about. And this economists who have written about these things have recognized this for a long time. And the most famous book is Crisis and Leviathan by Robert Higgs on the use of crises to generate even more governmental power. And Higgs has written quite a few articles on the web about the themes of Crisis and Leviathan, especially with regard to war, as far as that goes. Okay, see this? There are more questions for me here that... go ahead and write any more questions that you have. I'd be glad to continue answering. War is the health of the state. Here's one by Noah. Hayek wrote in support of the welfare programs, welfare state. I personally disagree with this. What's my opinion on welfare programs? I'm totally against the whole idea of government welfare. Private charity works much better when we have it. And not only that, government efforts crowd out private efforts. When the government announces it's going to spend many billions, supposedly to eradicate poverty, how a lot of people respond is to withdraw their own efforts. We don't participate in trying to help out the poor family in the neighborhood, something like that. The government will do it. When government takes over education, people don't spend as much effort educating their own children. When they take over old age insurance, people don't put forth as much effort taking care of their own parents and grandparents in their old age. The government will take care of them. This is one of the themes of two of books by Charles Murray. One is entitled Losing Ground, published around 1984 or so. And the other one is entitled In Pursuit. Subtitle is of Good Government, of Happiness and Good Government. And both of them talk about the phenomenon of the welfare state crowding out private charity, private initiative, and not only that, the welfare state has been a failure. Look at the people in American cities that live in public housing, surrounded by drug criminals because of the war on drugs, and the government-run schools that don't teach their children much of anything. If they do get diplomas, many of them are functionally illiterate. It's a disaster. It's a holy disaster. Murray documents exactly how it has caused a family breakup also. You have cities like mine, where I work in Baltimore, Maryland. The Baltimore Sun says that over 80% of African-American children that are born there are born without a father around. And that was not true 40 years ago, before the welfare state came big. One of the arguments Murray makes is that a moral hazard problem created by the welfare state is that a lot of men abandon their children because the guilt of economically not abandoning them economically is eliminated. The government will see to it that they at least have enough food and have shelter, and so men who abandon their own children are off the hook for paying for them to a large extent, even though they're not supposed to be legally. Many do anyway, but and that's been one of the other effects, negative effects of the welfare state. So it's hard to think of a greater catastrophe for society in peacetime than what the welfare state has created. And so I'd be against it. Let's see. Yeah, The Wire is a good, accurate description of life in Baltimore. Last week, a young 23-year-old man got off the train at Penn Station and was talking to his mother on the telephone, cell phone, and was stabbed to death, and his mother heard the whole thing. And the person who did it was a person who had been in and out of jail a dozen times for violent crimes. And that's the sort of thing that the social planners have given us in places like Baltimore. Let's see, what do I think of the fair tax and the flat tax? Steve Handel says, not much. As I said, the real focus needs to be on government spending. That's the real tax. The fair tax or the flat tax is just shuffling the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. As far as I'm concerned, if you don't pay attention to the overall level of government activity, that's the real focus. And the danger of the flat tax is that there's nothing keeping government from saying, okay, well, a flat tax of 25%, there's nothing keeping government from making it a flat tax of 35 or 55% someday. And so that's the real problem. And so I don't think it would be much of an improvement. Let's see. Grace, Steve Weiss asks, do you think the concept of fair trade is an attempt to move everyone to the lowest common denominator? That sounds like too conspiratorial to me, but usually fair trade is an argument made by protectionists who want no trade. And of course, you know, what in life is fair? You know, fair trade implies perfect equality, and we're not equal as human beings. We're all different. Every business is different. Every human being is different. And so it's hold on to your pocketbook when you hear business people talking about fair trade, because basically they mean that they would like to be able to raise their prices by restricting competition. Lisa wants to know if I see the government more as incompetent or sinister. Well, it's inherently incompetent because of the incentives of government. There's no market feedback mechanism like the market. In the market, if you cut costs and improve your product or your service, you make profit. If you do the opposite, you make losses. In government, that doesn't exist. There are no profit and loss statements in government. So if you let your costs get out of control and you let quality slide, like I said before, you actually are rewarded. Government will make the case that it needs more money. It's rewarded. And it is sinister. I think we've gotten to the situation in America where politicians just plunder us for their own benefit, and there is no longer any constraint to it because the Constitution isn't enforced. And so, and that is sinister. It's not just a matter of good-natured people being bumblers. I think there's a natural selection process going on here too, where the evil and sinister tend to gravitate toward politics, although there are exceptions like Ron Paul. Let's see. It's not fair that Florida has more alligators than Alabama. That is an inequality, for sure. Let's see. Jeremiah Dyke, though Glenn Beck is far from libertarian, do you think it was smart of him to choose The Road to Serfdom as a book of libertarian focus? Would you like him to pick another book? No, that was a good book to pick. That was a good book to pick. Glenn Beck has sounded very libertarian ever since Obama took office. Although when Ron Paul was running for president, he treated him horribly and crudely and boorishly, as did other people associated with the Fox News channel. They even kept him out of their televised debates and one of the debates that they held. And so, but then once Obama was elected, they wanted to have a voice of limited government. It'll be interesting to see that if the Republicans take over the White House in 2012, if the Fox News Channel remains as libertarian and allows Glenn Beck to talk like that and allows Judge Andrew Napolitano to keep his show on the Fox Business Channel. And so they never said anything like this during the Bush administration. There was no talk ever of limiting government on the Fox News Channel back then. Which book do I think is better, Road to Serfdom or Mises' Omnipotent Government? Well, the Road to Serfdom certainly sold more and was a big smash hit. Omnipotent Government wasn't translated into English until years later, but they're both excellent books on the same topic, and I like personally Omnipotent Government better, but the Road to Serfdom is more widely read. It's probably has sold millions by now. Of course, The Real Lincoln would be the best one to choose on this. Let's see. Grayson says there's a clip where Beck basically admits to Napolitano that he was wrong about a lot of libertarian versus neocon matters. Well, that's good. Milton Friedman and Hayek, can I contrast them? Well, they were both at the University of Chicago at the same time, but Hayek was not in the economics department. He taught there at something called the Committee for Social Thought, which was an interdisciplinary department at the University of Chicago. And there were a lot of brilliant people associated with that. And as far as, and they were both co-founders of the Mont Pelerin Society. They were both classical liberals. On monetary policy, they disagreed on the nature of the business cycle. Friedman is well known for saying that one of the main causes of the Great Depression is not enough monetary creation. The Fed did not create enough money. Hayek is associated with the Austrian business cycle theory, which contends the opposite, that it was expansionary monetary policy during the mid-20s that led to an artificial boom that could not be sustained. And when the bust occurred, that's what the Great Depression was. Friedman points to the fact that the Fed reduced the money supply from 1929 to 1932. But that doesn't explain the bust in 1929, the stock market crash and so forth. And so they were very different on that. Hayek was a member of the Austrian School of Economics, and so therefore he didn't believe in sort of the god of prediction, econometrics. He believed in the use of statistics. He taught statistics for a while. I've seen pictures of Hayek in a classroom in front of students, and on the blackboard he's teaching a basic course in statistics. But he did not believe that it could be used for prediction, because human beings are too malleable and change. Unlike physical aspects of the earth, of the world, human beings are not as predictable. And so he didn't believe in that, whereas Friedman was very dogmatic about it. Let's see, what am I looking at here? Yes, Friedman did write an introduction to the 1976 edition of The Road to Serfdom. That's true. Let's see. What was my opinion of George Gilder's book, Wealth and Poverty? I read that a long time ago when it was published in the early 80s, I think it was. And I remember liking it then. I haven't looked at it for a long time. I think it would be worthwhile reading. Yes, Hayek and Friedman had different economic methodologies, but I don't know if I want to get into it here in this class. Friedman came up with the idea of withholding the income tax. That is true. Friedman has talked about that. When he worked in the Treasury Department, I think it was, during World War II, and income tax withholding, he claims, was his idea. He regretted it. I heard him say regretted it, but that is true. Yeah, Friedman is what is called a positivist, Grayson says, in economic methodology. He believes that in order to increase our understanding, we have to develop hypotheses that are testable, whereas the Austrians dwell more on what they call a priori knowledge, using logic to determine human action, and you need not test everything against using econometrics or any other statistical type of analysis, and that you can understand the economic laws of the world without necessarily performing tests of everything. And so there is a methodological difference. Ben Bernanke claims that his expertise on the Great Depression comes from Milton Friedman. And as I said, Milton Friedman thinks that it was too little money in circulation that was the problem, and that is certainly what Ben Bernanke is operating by printing $1 trillion a day in some cases. Let's see. I'm not big on The Creature from Jekyll Island. It's a little slapstick for me. Although I'm not saying everything in it is untrue or anything like that, but I think it's a little too conspiratorial. Although it is true that there was a lobbying group of bankers and businessmen who wanted the Fed. The Mises Institute has held several conferences in Jekyll Island where this group of business people met to plot the Fed. And in one of the rooms there at this club, the private club on Jekyll Island, there are pictures of all these mostly New York bankers and businessmen who met there right before the Fed was created to plot the legislation. And so, you know, that did happen. I wouldn't pick The Creature from Jekyll Island. I would pick, if I was going to read one book on the history of central banking, I would read A Monetary History of the United States by Murray Rothbard. But first, I would read What Has Government Done to Our Money by Murray Rothbard. And then, if you're interested in the more historical aspects, A Monetary History of the United States by Rothbard would be the one. If you want to know, Steve Wise is asking about anything but elaborate on the differences between Friedman and Austrian economics. I would peruse the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, which is online, and you're bound to find some articles in the archives there somewhere that talk about the differences between the Austrians. I think Mark Skousen has also written a couple of books on just the economics profession in general. He has one fairly recently in the last couple of years. That's Skousen, Mark Skousen. He has a pretty good discussion of the differences between Austrians and the Friedmanites. Mark H. is asking for a book about what went on in the Iron Curtain, a book about the Soviet economy. Let's see. Soviet economy. Well, there have been so many over the years. You might look at A Requiem on Marx, edited by Yuri Maltsev, Maltsev, and published by the Mises Institute. It's a series of essays about Marxism and so forth. The book I mentioned earlier also, Planning Versus Prosperity, David Osterfeld talks about, summarizes the reasons why things never worked, the economy never worked under socialism. And of course, Ludwig von Mises wrote a famous book called Socialism in 1920, a big fat book that explained in tremendous detail why socialism would never work and was not working, and the Mises Institute just republished a very nice paperback version of it, so you can get it there. The Black Book of Communism explains all the murder and mayhem that was caused in the name of enforcing socialism. It doesn't say anything about the economic reasons why it failed, though. Murray Rothbard was an outstanding critic of Friedman. So Grayson just put up Milton Friedman Unraveled. That's one place to start. Mark Skousen is a statist, as Jack Pugley would say, whoever that is. He is a pretty knowledgeable economist, and you can learn something about the Austrian school and the Chicago school. I'm not saying I believe that everything he says is right, but it's a reference book. Marx and the Close of His System. I would recommend Requiem on Marx. There's some excellent essays in there by David Gordon, Hans Hermann Hoppe, Ralph Rako, and others. That would be a good reference. Well, I have about 8:30. Mark Orton, is Skousen an Austrian? No, he's a fellow traveler. He wouldn't call himself an Austrian, but he's a fellow traveler of the Austrians. A few more questions. What is a greater threat to liberty, a big federal government or a big local government? Well, of course, a big federal government is by definition bigger, as far as that goes. In at least local government, you can escape. You can move to another local government somewhere, but to escape the federal government, you have to escape to a different country, which, where would you go? And so you have a better ability to vote with your feet, as the political scientists say, if local government becomes tyrannical. And by the way, the whole states' rights thing never said, Jefferson or the rest never said that local politicians or state politicians were necessarily more moral or smarter or anything than other politicians. But they said they could hardly be worse than central government politicians because they are at least closer to the people, where the people can chastise them for their bad behavior more directly. And you can escape. You can go to another state. But once it's all centralized, you can't go anywhere. It's too cost prohibitive to go anywhere. And that's basically the case they made. They didn't make the case that state governments are always wise or they're not corrupt. Yes, they're corrupt, but they could not possibly be as corrupt as a central government. That's the point they made. What's the main difference between human action and man economy and state? They were written by different authors. Basically, if you want an introduction to Austrian economics, I would personally read Man, Economy, and State first. Human action is not necessarily more difficult, but it's really just more comprehensive, and it combines a lot more philosophy and history and other disciplines. And Man, Economy, and State is just a really great economics book. And it's not totally economics. There is some interdisciplinary work there, but human action is just more more voluminous in terms of its treatment from different disciplines. And so I would start with Man, Economy, and State. Actually, I would start with Power and Market by Murray Rothbard, and then I would read Man, Economy, and State, and then Human Action if I wanted to embark on education in Austrian economics. And of course, the very, very basic first place to start would be Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. Let's see. Okay, somebody's mentioned Free to Choose. By the way, if you go on the web to something called Freedom Channel, and I think there are two Freedom Channels, so go to the one that has all the John Stossel videos. The Free to Choose videos are all on there. It was made into, a 12-part series on PBS, and Friedman himself is the moderator. And so, and it's all listed online at freedomchannel.org, I think it is. And the Free to Choose book is a good primer on economics, too. Bob's asking about The Last Night of Liberalism. He's talking about the biography of Ludwig von Mises by Guido Hulsmann. It's a biography. I wouldn't read that first. I would know something about von Mises first. It's an intellectual biography and a personal biography. It's 1,000 pages long, and it talks about the development of von Mises' ideas as well as just his life. And you really have to know something about Austrian economics first before you can really make the most of the discussion of the intellectual ideas and their development. Let's see, Thomas Sowell is a commentator. He's also a PhD economist. He got his PhD at the University of Chicago, where Friedman was one of his teachers, and he taught at UCLA for many years, and then he became associated with the Hoover Institution and is a syndicated columnist. He's written probably 3 or 4 dozen books also. As far as books, go online at Mises.org. There are a lot of great books that they put online for free that you can read. And by the way, there are study guides for Man, Economy, and State and Human Action produced by Bob Murphy. And so if you do want to take on those books, you've got great study guides that summarize each chapter and do a very good job of it and make it very understandable. As Profit and Loss is a good publication, online again, or you can buy it. Yeah, the iPencil example, that's online at the fee.org, FEE.org. Leonard Reed, the founder of the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE, wrote the essay, iPencil, and you can get it on the web. And I hand it out, every undergraduate class I teach, I hand it out the first day of class. And it's the first lesson that every economics student should learn, the iPencil. Okay, I've got 8:36 and the questions are slowing down here, so I guess we should call it a course then. Thank you all for participating. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got a lot out of it. I hope you all take more courses with the Mises Institute, Mises Academy. I'm going to put up on the web a syllabus for a course I'm going to start teaching in September on the political economy of war, which I've taught at the university level already, but I'm going to make it a web course now. And so good luck to you all. We'll have one more quiz, and I hope you get a very beautiful certificate in the mail about your high grade in the course. And have a good night, and Grayson will take over from here, I suppose. I'll go very easy on the last quiz.